But look, honestly, if you zoom out even a little bit, all this stuff is so underhyped. Like, you can't hype it enough, right? I mean, it's just like, it's just amazing.
It's incredible.
This technology works really well. It affects so many industries. People are like maybe disappointed that like it didn't solve every single one of their business problems like right now. And it's like, relax. Like, obviously, it will soon.
Just wait.
Just wait. Yeah. Wait a month, you know?
How did the best machine learning practitioners get involved in the field? What challenges have they faced? What has helped them flourish? Let's ask them. Welcome to Learning from Machine Learning. I'm your host, Seth Levine.
Hello and welcome to Learning from Machine Learning. On this episode, we have a very special guest, Lucas Biewald, the co-founder and CEO of Weights and Biases, the host of one of my favorite podcasts, Gradient Descent, one of the earliest AI entrepreneurs, starting Crowdflower Figure Eight back in 2007. Lucas, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're gonna get right into it. So what initially attracted you to machine learning?
I was always interested in AI generally. Like, you know, even when I was a kid, I think I really liked to play games. And so I thought a lot, you know, I would try to program, you know, my own kind of like rule-based systems to, you know, to win at like Connect Four and stuff like that. So I was thinking about that a lot. And, you know, my dad actually read me that book, Gerd Lesher Bach, and I didn't understand much of it at all, but it has these great like parts where there's these like sort of stories. And so the stories are pretty compelling. And then I think, you know, with that kid mind, I was like, you know, AI does seem like humanity's last project and kind of the most interesting thing you could possibly work on. And then I went to Stanford and I actually reached out cold to Daphne Koller, who was kind of a young, you know, professor there at the time, and asked her like, you know, what I should do. And she's like, okay, take my class in machine learning. The class was so much fun because it was kind of like the fun parts. And actually the best part of the class was this kind of reinforcement learning piece where you train a Othello program through reinforcement learning to get good at Othello. And yeah, from that point I was hooked, because that's actually, Othello's a really satisfying reinforcement learning project you could even do back then, where, you know, I kind of watched that program, you know, over a few nights, basically go from terrible, where, you know, it couldn't beat anyone, to just like, you know, crushing me every single time. And actually, it's funny, you know, I got way better at Othello playing that game. I've actually never lost at Othello since training that computer, because the computer's kind of teaching me how to play towards the end of it. Although I've never played like a, I don't know, professional or like, you know, skilled Othello player. But yeah, I mean, that was like the point where I got like, you know, really, really kind of hooked on it. And then it kind of went through like a sad part. So I started doing research with Daphne. I kind of thought, okay, maybe, you know, I want to be like a professor of this. But, you know, this is back in like 2004, 2005. There really was not a lot of stuff working. I mean, Google was like working really well, but a lot of that was kind of like PageRank. And, you know, a lot of the energy was around sort of like, you know, ranking ads. It didn't, you know, that didn't feel like that satisfying. And like, I interviewed like some hedge funds and, you know, I was like, okay, like, I don't know if that's really like, you know, what I wanted to dedicate, you know, my life to. And I was actually thinking like, okay, you know, label data is kind of driving all the research, which is why I got into like the data labeling business. Cause I thought, okay, you know, like if we could create more label data, we could create more interesting applications, which is kind of like what I always, you know, was kind of the most fun part of machine learning, is like, you know, really seeing what it can do. And man, I've like lost even what the question was, but I'm
no, it's perfect. So that leads you right into 2007, founding your, that was your first company that you founded, right?
Yep.
You were way ahead of the game. You were way ahead of the game.
Yeah, although, you know, it's funny, you say I was like one of the first like AI entrepreneurs. I don't think that's actually true. I mean, there's been like a long, you know, people have been building AI companies, you know, since the 70s, 80s. Like, so, you know, I think like the definition of AI kind of changes, you know, like once, you know, we get something working, we like no longer maybe consider it AI all the time.
Right, right.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, that was actually sort of like, you know, it's like an AI winter. It was also sort of like an, you know, economic winter where, you know, there's, you know, like Y Combinator just started. But if you look at those early stuff, you know, those are kind of much weirder ideas. And now I raised my first round. It took a year to raise a round on $2 million, you know, valuation, and we had revenue. So it's really a different time. Like Facebook was just starting to take off. And so another thing that was funny back then was I was building an AI labeling company, but I was kind of coached to take AI, you know, out of the pitch. Cause that, I mean, it was such an AI winner that like investors did not want to invest in anything like related to AI. That just seemed like a bad science project. So, you know, that was like a real sign of the times, but you know, it's funny because what was happening actually behind the scenes is like, you know, these companies were starting to find success. And so, you know, the label, like our labeling product, you know, got some quick traction with actually eBay was kind of like our first really big customer, and that really pulled us along.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of really interesting points that I've been talking about also recently, like the moving goalposts of AI, right? Because like once it works, it's just an algorithm. It's like, I always think about computer vision, and I think about like face detection and things like that. I mean, those are just algorithms. But if you thought, you know, whatever decades before, if there would be a thing in your pocket that could identify where your face was, right, that would be obviously magical. Now we just think about it like it's just a given. Like, of course, that's how things work. So I guess the modern era of AI entrepreneurship. I guess what I was saying earlier to the game, there are still companies that are trying to solve those same data labeling problems that you were addressing in 2007. So you could really kind of understand, you had some inkling of something amazing happening. I mean, think about it. That was, you know, nearly 20 years ago, and we're still trying to solve these problems, right? Yeah. I usually ask, like, was there a moment that convinced you that this was the field that you wanted to build your career in? But it sounds like it was pretty early on. Or was there something later that happened where you were like, yeah, this is definitely what I want to be doing?
No, I mean, I think it was really early. Like, I mean, like, really like a little kid kind of thinking about AI. I think I remember somebody's dad, I think, told me about like simulated annealing, they used to call it, which is kind of like a gradient descent thing. And he told me like something was like designed in that way where they like had the computer like try different weights and then gradually make the weights better. That really, it's really just captured my imagination. I was like, you know, like I was writing code. I was like, what if computers could write this code? Like, you know, when you're a kid, you actually like, it's not obvious that like, you know, facial recognition would be hard, but like, you know, multiplying two huge numbers together would be easy. Like you kind of come to that, you know, over time. And so I think I had like a lot of optimism, which was sort of like slowly, you know, crushed out of me through like, you know, actually like trying to do it, you know, from like, you know, 2003 to maybe like 2016. And actually, it's funny. I was a big Go player. Like I loved playing Go. I think one of the things I liked about it was that computers were so bad at it. And if you do play Go, you kind of understand why. Like it's interesting. It's like, you know, Go is like really designed for our brains to do it well in a super cool and satisfying way. But you know, I remember when I was running, Cloudflare Figure Eight when AlphaGo beat Lee Sedol.
Yeah,
I mean, because I'm like a huge Go fan. I was like, actually, you know, I was like watching those games live and like, you know, watching the commentary and really thinking about it. And it was like, I actually had not really paid attention to the advances in deep learning. Like at that point, if anyone was ever like, hey, we have a new algorithm that does things better, you just have like huge skepticism because people kept saying that it wasn't true, especially in like the entrepreneurial space. It's a good pitch, you know, but it's actually like generally not true. So I was like super skeptical that, you know, AlphaGo was going to beat Lee Sedol. And then, you know, when it did, I was just like, oh my God, you know, like this is like, that's kind of what made me realize like, okay, I need to, you know, kind of get more technical again. And I was like, look, I mean, that's like how I ended up, you know, doing an unpaid internship at OpenAI. This is like very brief and wasn't on their payroll or anything, but I was like, I just need to go somewhere where people are doing the latest stuff and work with them. Because I, you know, running a data labeling company, you work with like AI customers, but you're not really doing a lot of AI internally. So I kind of was, it's funny. I was like, you know, in my 30s and kind of feeling bad about myself. Like I had just become this like totally like deeply non-technical person and just sort of like a mediocre, you know, like entrepreneur and like just didn't, you know, even really know like, you know, what was kind of going on in the space. And so I'm so happy that I did that because I think that like led to me getting a lot more technical again and like actually like getting to enjoy this new era where like all the AI stuff works and like things surprise you by how fast they come rather than like how slow they come. Yeah.
Yeah. going back to the point that you were making earlier, it's like back in whatever, say the mid 2000s, when you didn't want to say AI in your pitch, thinking about what that's like now, where every single entrepreneur, whether it is AI or it's not AI, they'll just say it. It's become more of like a marketing term. And then, yeah, the other point that you're making with Go, that's like one of the main stories in the book Genius Makers. And they talk about that, like something. Yeah. Yeah, where it was not intuitive for a human to make that move, but it ended up being the right move, which is just such an interesting idea with AI in general, just like the ability for it to pick up patterns. But it's more than just picking up patterns, it's picking up patterns that humans might not be able to detect, which, yeah, unless you're kind of really in it, it's hard to understand the power of it.
And I'll tell you, like, for the true Go aficionado, which I'm not like I don't play a lot of Go these days, but I am like pretty interested in it. When I was a kid, I played a ton of Go, and I would always think like, okay, like what would like God do? You know what I mean? Like, I wish I could know, because it feels so weird. It's like, you know, the kind of optimal first move is like, you know, the 4-4 point, or maybe the 4-3 point, which is just like, it's not the center of the board, it's not the edge of the board. It's just like, yeah, I'm kind of like, okay. And then that's debated, like, is like 4-4 better or 4-3 better? And all these openings, there's a lot of like tradition and like, you know, you're kind of like, okay, how true is it? Like, and there are people who come up with these like wild styles, and they like work pretty well. And I just always was wondering, like, could we find out in my lifetime, like what the best, you know, moves are? And then when they trained it, like the AlphaZero thing, where they trained it with like not on professional games. So I think the one that beat Lee Sedol was mostly trained on professional games and then a little bit of self-play to get a little bit better. But it kind of had a more like a style that like came from humans. But then the ones trained without any human input are so interesting, both where they find like, you know, kind of famous human openings and like those, but also there were a few things that were missed, like really like obvious things that you could go back, you know, 20 years and actually explain them to like any Go player. And the whole world of Go players, like, you know, like all these people just missed like these like choices that AI found. I think it's like just so cool and so profound. Yeah. I mean, a little bit happens in chess, but I think Go is like more weird. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm also kind of into the chess. I'm less proficient at it and know it less well, but it's pretty fun watching, you know, the new chess programs that are trained off of, again, from scratch. And they're so much more aggressive than like the Deep Blues and stuff. And that makes me feel better about my unsound chess play.
So I can't speak to my Go, but chess for sure. I used to love playing chess. I wish I had more time. And then I also think about like poker and things like that. Yeah. And how much there is. Yes, there is like the mathematical, statistically correct, you know, move to make in every position. But there's also the game that you're playing, and there's the styles that you can have. So it's interesting to think about that. And the parallel that I'm thinking with, you know, frontier models and LLMs and things like that is like personas. I'm thinking about that also almost as like the style in which you want something to be, you know, behaving in whatever environment you're in with them. So that's interesting, dependent on the context and dependent on like, you know, what the prompt is. You could have two very intelligent models and they could respond, they could respond differently. Yeah.
Well, but just to be clear, I'm making a difference. I mean, like, so Go, there's one best style.
Oh, it is. Okay.
So, oh yeah. So like, you know, cause it's a full information game, like chess, right? So like, there's a best way, there's the best move at any point, obviously. And so I think, you know, it's just, I think that the models trained without human input now find it, you know, find a better, more effective style than the ones trained on humans. It sort of reveal that, you know, humans do some suboptimal.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I got you. I guess the thing that I was thinking about with chess was you could have the best move, or in poker, you could have the best move given that you think somebody's going to then respond to you thinking that they're going to respond properly, but you don't know exactly what they're going to respond. So in chess, you could have a move where you're planning 1, 2, 3 moves ahead, but you know, some of the best players are thinking multiple 10, 15 moves ahead. Is it like that with Go also?
Maybe. I don't know. I guess I don't like to,
yeah, it's okay,
to play that way. I mean, you know, like, I think, you know, you can, I think generally like relying on, you know, your opponent to make a mistake is a dangerous, you know, mindset. So what I'm talking about is the programs that try to play optimally. I know that I think chess programs sometimes like they try to train it, you know, to play like a human and, you know, make mistakes like a human. And I'm sure you could, you know, take advantage of human tendencies like more effectively and like crush them even more like thoroughly. But I think these, yeah, these programs, you know, beat humans 100% of the time, you know, and it, like by just playing optimally too. So,
yeah, it's pretty amazing how how fast that has happened. I mean, like, I guess, you know, decades ago, people, I guess there were a lot of different feelings on the matter, but these sorts of games, yeah, the machine can win in all of these now. So was it the idea of gradient, like the magic behind gradient descent, the ability for machines to get better over time, that was the thing that kind of attracted you to it, or was it more than that?
Well, in a way, that's all there is, right? But I mean, there's like what you draw from that, which is like if computers can program other computers, then you can solve literally every problem that humans face, right? I just think when you have that like sort of recursive ability, you know, to automatically improve algorithms, I think that's just the most powerful technology that you could possibly build. It sort of subsumes every other endeavor that you might try.
Yeah. All right, gonna go for a hard pivot into fast forwarding to founding of Weights and Biases. What was the initial impetus there?
Well, you know, I think it was, I think it, in some ways for me personally, it was a reaction to, you know, what I liked and didn't like around Cloudflare Figure Eight. So, you know, I think I felt like Cloudflare Figure Eight, it's a good business. I mean, Scale AI is like taking it and, you know, run, you know, really far with it. It's a good business, but it's might not be the perfect business for me to be, you know, running. Like, I think I'm a little more oriented towards wanting to sell to developers, like wanting to make like high quality products. And I think I also just felt like a passion around it, like more than like, this seemed like a good business model. I was like, you know, I really respect the people that are building these AI models. I'd like to help them. Like, I think like, you know, what I have to offer is like kind of understanding like how they work and like how to make their work better. You know, my co-founder, Sean and Chris and I, we were just really passionate about like moving forward to the state of the art of AI. We felt like what we had to offer was good developer tools. You know, we had been pretty close to the GitHub founders and kind of watched them, you know, be successful. Also, I think one thing that was helpful to see was the GitHub founders at first, everyone's like, oh, developer tools, that's a small market, that's a stupid thing to work on. But it's sort of like developers became really powerful within their organizations because like what they're doing is automating companies. I think what we were thinking with Weights and Biases is, you know, these AI developers, even smaller market, it's like a subset of developers, but they're even more powerful within their organizations, right? Because they're automating the automation, right? So like, let's get on their side. Let's like make stuff that's like good for them. And, you know, that's going to be a great thing to offer the world.
Yeah, definitely. So Weights and Biases was founded back in 2018. So it's a different machine learning landscape then. I fell in love with Weights and Biases back in 2019.
Nice, good for you. Love
yeah,
it.
I used it to track experiments. I think, I'm not sure if it was even earlier, but definitely one of my first big projects, I was like, I need to figure out a better way than writing all of my results down, and I want this to be automated. I was like, oh, okay, I could just add this these three lines of code. That sounds great.
Love it.
And now what it has evolved into, oh my God, it's like, so at the time I was just, you know, logging classification reports and confusion matrices. Now, I don't even know if it's like a standard thing. I put like my visualizations, I have like these data map plots that I put into Weights and Biases.
Nice.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun with it. I've told every machine learning person that I know how much I really, Weights and Biases has made my career so much better, like just so much better. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for that comment. That feels really good.
Yeah, definitely. I hope you hear that because it's amazing. It's an amazing tool. I guess maybe what happens is people start taking it for granted, but no, it has become ingrained in the way that we do work. 100%. So yeah. But what I was going to talk about or ask you is basically like, yeah, the machine learning landscape has changed. 2018, I think it was, I don't know what I was working on, a lot of just like classification stuff. And now 2025, we have the LLM for the last, like, what, 3 years, I guess. It's a very different landscape, the generative landscape. So how has the vision evolved for weights and biases? Can you talk, like, yeah, just with the landscape changing and, yeah, just can totally. You touch upon that?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest change by far to the landscape, I think, is that, you know, when we started, like, you'd mostly build your own model, and like fine tuning was like, some people would do it. It seemed like maybe a good idea, but it was actually kind of unusual. And now I think many, many tasks, you can just, you know, use an off the shelf LM. You could go to if you want to translate something, you don't need to build a translation model. You can ask OpenAI, literally just ask it to translate something. Right. And so many of the tasks now are just asking LMs the right way. And then we have like these new, even more exciting tasks where it's like chaining the stuff together and using tools, which you call like agentic systems. And I think that's where, you know, most of the interesting innovation is. I do think DeepSeek in particular caused a resurgence of people wanting to do their own reinforcement learning. So we are, you know, seeing actually more users coming on board to like Weights and Biases' original product than ever, which is like really satisfying. But, you know, it's like a different style of thing, right? Your models are enormous. You're typically, you're always running on like GPUs, often, you know, a lot of GPUs running in a distributed way. Like that's like kind of table stakes. Like it was kind of exotic when we started. Like OpenAI was the only one doing distributed training for a long time on weights and biases. And now I think, you know, anybody really trying to do like meaningful scale is doing a distributed training of some variety. So look, what happened was, I mean, we have this one kind of product that does experiment tracking that was really popular that we now call our models product, just to give it a name. That's a WB, you know, Python package you download, you know. But we added a product called Weave that's designed, you know, just for like running LLMs and kind of all the work that happens around that. And the two work actually great together, right? Because, you know, a lot of people, you want to build a model, then you want to like run it. But I think that the number of people who would have a need for a product like Weave that could, you know, track an LLM that they got off the shelf is much bigger than the number of people, you know, building AI models. So I think what we actually saw was this democratization of AI that everybody had talked about, and where like anyone can really harness, you know, the power of AI. And then, you know, they get all the kind of drawbacks of AI too, right? Like, you know, just because you're running a third-party LLM, it's like still non-deterministic. You know, it's still like really hard, you know, like to know how to test it. Like, you know, you're never going to have 100% test coverage when you have a non-deterministic, you know, LLM underneath, you know, your system. And you're going to have to think a lot about like, okay, like what are the metrics I'm actually trying to optimize here? How do I make them better? You know, what's different is like, you know, people kind of coming to that new without any, you know, machine learning training, you know, they're not as comfortable with statistics as the average, you know, like ML person. And they don't even necessarily in the beginning see the value in evaluations, right? Because it's kind of annoying to set up evaluations. And you just wouldn't think of it. You'd be like, I'll see if it's good. And then I'll like, you know, ship it. And so I think in the early days of Weights and Biases, no one would be like, I shouldn't do evaluations. We're like, how do we do evaluations? Right. Now, I think with LLMs, you kind of actually have to convince people to do evaluations. I do think there's a flip side of that, though. Like, I think ML researchers had this tendency to just look at aggregate statistics. And a lot of what our product would try to do is, like, get you to, like, look at, you know, individual examples and see what's happening. Because there's a lot there, usually. And usually ML researchers don't do enough of that. I think you see the flip side of that in, like, this, like, LLM world where, you know, people talk about testing by vibes, but testing by vibes is actually like trying the thing, looking at some examples. It's a really good thing to do, you know. So now that happens enough, maybe too much, and there's not enough look at the aggregate statistics, because, you know, it's like vibes will get you really far. Vibes is really good at keep preventing you from doing crazy things and having like these horrible, you know, like deployment stuff. You know, if you're trying to like nudge inaccuracy higher, which is kind of where every project ends up, and you want to get like from 69 to 71% accuracy to 73 to whatever, that's where you actually really need evaluations, because you can't kind of make like incremental steady progress without, you know, clear metrics that you're improving.
Yeah, 100%. So I guess a couple of things. Yeah, so I loved when you guys came out with tables. I thought that was really cool, because I was able to, in Weights and Biases, actually look and group my data and find and see particular examples. And I built, and I've used Weave. Weave is so cool. Some of the things that I really like about it is the tracing. So when you have, say, like multiple LLM calls, you have, you know, certain tracing. And what I really like is that you can see where what parts of the code were touched with that area. And I haven't really been able to get that sort of detail anywhere else. So that's one of the reasons why I like using Weave. And then, yeah, just to get into like evaluations, I think people, the hard thing is it's very hard to evaluate generative outputs. What makes a summary, one summary better than another summary? And you have to sort of think about different criteria of what it's going to be on. And then to go into your point, yeah, like you have to have a robust evaluation system, because anytime you're making any kinds of changes into this system, whether it's prompt engineering or whether it's using a new model, whatever, changing hyperparameter, whatever you're doing, there are always trade-offs that happen. And if you don't have a robust way of evaluating it, going from something that, oh, it looks good, you know, like, oh, I think it's good, I tried it out on 10 prompts, I tried it out on 10 examples, it looks good, compared to like, oh no, like I need to get this performance up from 75 to 85. Any change that I'm making, I have to make sure. So what I've been doing is I just keep building my evaluation set, right? Just I get it done end to end, and then I'll test 10 things, and then I'll make sure it still performs on those 10 things, and it'll be 20, 30, 40. And then like all of a sudden you're like, whoa, I have like 150 things that I'm testing on this thing. All right, you know, it's still not going to capture everything when I bring it to, you know, when an actual user uses it, because you can't ever. You have to continue to just kind of figure out, you know, how your users are using your model. But at least I understand there's no regressions in some of the capabilities that I wanted it to have from the get-go. Totally. So I think LLM observability is really hard. It's a challenging problem, and it's hard because I know what it's like from your perspective. What weights and biases does is a general tool that can be applied to specific problems, but which I guess is a lot of software, obviously, but particularly for something where there's just no real rule book. There's no like, oh, like check the F1 score, you know, for like traditional machine learning. It's not that simple. So it's hard to know what to observe when it's unclear exactly like what people want to be building with it. So it must be very challenging, I'd say. I don't know. How do you deal with that? Like where the goals of the people using your product are evolving so fast. Is that something that you think about?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, it's exciting. It's like, you know, I think the entrepreneur in me gets like really excited. You know, I think it's, you know, it kind of favors smaller companies in a way, right? Like when you need to like really iterate quickly. So I think like one of the funny challenges that I find myself in is trying to, you know, make like, you know, 250 plus person company, you know, recently acquired by 1,000 person, you know, company, like just keep like, you know, iterating quickly. Thank you. Like I think we have to move really fast. And we have to like listen really carefully to like, what people are doing. But you know, I think like, you don't have to solve every problem, right? So like, you know, I think we talk to our customers all the time, and we like look at their workflows, and you see like, okay, people want to make these like small sets they can quickly look at. You know, like LM as a judge is like a really popular strategy. There's different kind of patterns around that. There's also like, you know, making sure that like users can actually like, you know, put popular feedback back into Weave. And there's often like, you know, sets of data where it's just like, you can never like get this one wrong. Like we never want like anything, you know, bad about our brand, or like, you know, we don't anything like sexual in our result, you know, like, so you get like what ends up happening, I think, in the same way that like, you know, we kind of know that we were dealing with like a serious like ML company when they'd have like thousands of metrics, right? Cause you sort of like over time, you just get more and more metrics that you're like tracking around whatever you're doing. Cause it's like, in some sense, you're always optimizing one number, but nobody really thinks like that. You know, like they want to see all the different things that are happening, because they don't really know that what they're exactly optimizing. So they want to look a lot. I think the same way is like with evals, where it's like, you know, over time, you know, there's all these different considerations that you have of what means good. And so you start adding more and more, you know, evaluation sets. And so I think that's where things move. And like, you know, we don't have to do everything for you. We're like, we want to do the most like helpful stuff. But I think a lot of people should be writing their own evals. There's a lot of great like third party open source evals libraries that, we try to support really well. And we also try to make like it work easily out of the box, so people can at least get like a taste of, you know, the power of what we have.
Very cool. We'll go into this one. What are you most excited about the future for weights and biases?
Well, I think like, you know, we're now inside of a public company with really big ambitions. And I think like, you know, one thing that's exciting is that, you know, they have, you know, they have a ton of resources available to build, you know, lots of stuff. So I think, like, you know, we had to be really careful about, like, where we, like, aimed our, you know, resources. But we knew there's, like, tons of other, like, steps in the AI workflow that, like, where we felt like, you know, we could do a better job of building great stuff. But, you know, we also wanted to stay focused. But I think now it's, like, there's a bigger scope here where kind of any step in the AI workflow is kind of like fair game or something like we could build. That gets really exciting to be able to build more stuff. And I think, you know, we obviously like don't want to only work with CoreWeave, and we want to be really careful about always saying that. Like, we're going to work with like every cloud. Like, it's always going to work with all the different, you know, like infrastructure providers out there. But it's kind of interesting to like actually see like real life, you know, infrastructure and hardware deeply, because it does show you there's like more stuff you could surface that I think would like kind of help the end user, especially the AI researcher. Like, I think we could do more to like let them know, like, hey, you know, weird things are happening in your in your hardware stack and your training that you may want to take a look at. We have a conference coming up in a couple weeks called Fully Connected. And we're going to announce a whole bunch of like integrations there that's kind of the tip of the iceberg of what I'm excited about.
Cool. Yeah, that's exciting. We met last year at Fully Connected. That's a great conference. Yeah. In terms of, you know, joining a larger company and, you know, understanding more of the integration and scaling and things like that. So, yeah, you're thinking there's just a more diverse problem set or more areas where you could kind of help your end users, or you're understanding things better? Or yeah, like what excites you about that?
Well, I think it's like, you know, we go head to head against like Amazon, you know, we're friendly with Amazon, but they have a competing product for like most of the stuff that we do. And most of their product is like garbage, you know, and you know, I don't even know if they would like, you know, if you privately like meet these people, they'll like tell you that like they think the Weights and Biases, you know, product is better. Boy, I'm not making any friends with this comment, but I think honestly, like, I think like we've picked off a few things and done them really well. I think at an executive level, though, you know, people want to buy a complete solution, right? No developer wants that. But for some reason, I shouldn't say for some reason, I understand why. Like, executives and companies kind of want to buy like one complete solution, have it be like cohesive and sell it. And I think like, you know, it's kind of a danger for Weights and Biases, the product, right? Like, you know, people would use like MLflow because they're like a Databricks shop. And they're just like, look, I wish I could use Weights and Biases, but like, you know, Databricks comes with like MLflow for free, and my boss is saying I have to use it, you know? Like, I think there's a lot of power immediately in bringing these two companies together, like CoreWeave and Weights and Biases. Like, now we can offer like more complete solutions. You know, CoreWeave is also incredibly fast, like revenue growth, like far faster than us because of this, you know, amazing demand for hardware, and they execute really well. And so we can also like, you know, use some of their resources to build a more complete solution, which is probably where the world is ultimately going. So I think like, you know, we could have gone on alone, but as an entrepreneur, you're always kind of like looking for ways to like get an edge, because you know, it's these markets tend to be like winner take all or winner take most. And so like, you know, I'm pretty focused on like, okay, how do we like completely dominate, you know, this market, like not end up in some sort of niche category?
Yeah. Sort of transitioning into the entrepreneurship parts of things, it's interesting thinking about tech solutions and how there are many solutions, obviously, for many problems. That's like, you know, the exciting thing about being in this, in any, you know, market. But basically, like Weights and Biases has a lot of competitors. There's open source competitors. There's other third parties. There's complete companies around it. There are companies where they're just doing things. I mean, you know, you spoke about Amazon a little bit. It's like, yeah, like Amazon has their own foundation models too. You know, but like I don't know a single person that's using them. And they also invested in other foundation models. So they have these huge incentives. But to go back to the other point, there's an interesting thing. If you think about all the problems that are flowing down, like you try to like get a bucket, and you try to like find that bucket that you're gonna capture a lot of the problems that you're getting. But then at a certain point, if you're a company that's buying these vendors, it's like, well, how many buckets am I gonna have? I want one solution that's gonna solve all of these things. And then sometimes, you know, you might not be able to focus narrowly on the problem. So I mean, I know like you definitely think somewhat about this, but I'm curious, like, what's your take on this whole there being many solutions for things and like tech consolidation. Yeah, like you sort of touched upon it, but do you think about that in the industry that you're in?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think what like markets tend to do is like when there's some like new problem and you need new capabilities, I think that tends to favor smaller companies, right? So you get this kind of Cambrian explosion of, you know, different options, and then the sort of biggest ones tend to consolidate. And so, you know, I think we're kind of seeing, you know, consolidation of like some stuff. Like I think like there's a time when like MLOps is like all the rage, right? You don't like hear about that anymore. I think that's like definitely like, you know, kind of consolidating market, you know. But then there's like also a lot of new like LM, you know, functionality around like, I don't know, like routing. Like how, you know, how many companies need like a router today? Like probably not a lot. Like will they need a router in the future? Probably most will want one, right? So that's like a really interesting, you know, category of thing, and there's a bunch of companies there, and you know, I think there'll probably be more and then over time there'll be less, right? Because, you know, like maybe that's not really like a standalone business. I'm not sure, you know, maybe the ones that are doing it will sort of expand into, you know, other categories. I think that's just sort of like life and technology. But I think with you know, AI and the speed of innovation, it just happens like way faster than it used to.
Yeah. I think I'm stealing a question that you ask your guests. What's a free idea? Do you ask that, right? Like what's an idea if you had any time in the world that you think?
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like I ask it more like in a non-commercial context where I'm actually just kind of curious, like, cause I always think of it, it's like, okay, if I'm not doing this, like what would I like really do? You know, it's a good question to ask yourself, you know, kind of what's interesting.
Yeah.
Out there. Like in terms of, I mean, startup ideas, like, man, it's like, I don't know. It just seems like such a fun time to be an entrepreneur right now. Cause I feel like, I mean, this is not like a secret, but like you take this into like any like application and it just like still blows people's minds, right? Like people just do not connect the dots between LM generally and LM applied to like a particular, you know, problem people have. And so I'm just seeing like all this like, you know, success in that and enthusiasm. I think people kind of think they're late. Like my friends will talk to me and be like, oh, am I too late to this? Like, nah, man, you're like still early. It's amazing. You know, just like,
right.
Like I think LLMs applied to anything. It's probably like a good idea, honestly. You know, I don't know. Like, I think it's like good to pick ideas that you kind of care about. I mean, again, I'm not like telling anybody the things that they probably don't know, but it's like, you know, the progress in robotics right now is like unbelievably exciting, you know, and yeah, that's obviously going to be like this huge thing. And again, I think you might think you're late, but you're early, you know, if you're like looking into that. So, yeah, I don't know, that's kind of like what I'm kind of intrigued by, but you know, it's like when you're doing a company, you really don't have time for anything else, you know? So,
I know, the potential for robotics is just too exciting. I mean, being able to combine sort of all of the power of LLMs along with, you know, computer vision and all that, I think that's a really exciting, really, really exciting field. I'm so curious to see what's going to be coming out in the next couple of years and what people are currently working on. Zooming out to just like kind of machine learning in general, and, you know, maybe we touched upon it, maybe we didn't, but What do you think is an important question that you believe remains unanswered in machine learning?
I mean, there's a lot. I think like, I don't know, one thing I'm like kind of like intrigued by is like, you know, if you ran back like history like 1,000 times, you know, like how much of, you know, what we do around like a transformer architecture would be consistent, and how much is a sort of product of like, you know, how we do it. Like, I think like, you know, there's just not a lot of like appetite for experimenting with stuff, and people don't tend to write it down when they get just the same result. Like, I feel like, you know, there used to be like LSTMs and GRUs and all these different architectures. I kind of feel like I even remember like trying to like program these things by hand and like getting a little bit wrong, and it's like still fine, you know? So I wonder a lot about like how much this architecture, like what are the sort of like core bits of this architecture that really matter? And then of course, like, we now design our chips around this transformer architecture, so it's so like locked in, you know, you wouldn't like want to change the aspects of it. But I mean, I think that's maybe like an intellectual question that I wonder about a lot. And I think, I mean, there's been an explosion of research in reinforcement learning right now, which I think is totally makes sense, but I'm having trouble comprehending. I'm talking way, like, this is what I'm trying to like understand right now, is like what about these different like reward functions make them effective or not? I don't know. I'm confused. Maybe somebody understands it, but I'm more confused these days than I was in the past.
Yeah. We have a mutual friend that would understand. John Shulman would understand proximal policy optimization. But anyway, going back to the other point, transformers, and I think about it too. I think about this with everything in life also. Is it just a local maximum or is it a global, you know, or, you know, for grading, is it a local minimum or is it a global? Like, is this the most optimal? And then I just was speaking about it, but also like, yeah, like, the 2017 architecture is not the 2025 architecture, and that's because the bet was placed. And the bet was placed, and the infrastructure was put into place, and the chips were made, and the ecosystems were created, and then you start iterating on something. And if you make a choice, and you iterated on it for 8 years, and you start to solve all of those problems that people were having, it's like you're going to get it to a place where it's really good. And then we are seeing that we're probably going to hit a ceiling. But I think that already it's unlocked so much. And just like what going to your previous answer, just applying LLMs anywhere you're going to be able to get value. So it's going to be very interesting to see sort of what happens. This is another one that I like to ask. How do you view the gap between the hype and the reality of AI?
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so like hype is tricky because I live in San Francisco and I don't really know like the level of hype like out in the world. Like it seems like very like uneven. Like I'm always kind of surprised what like resonates with my friends, you know, in other geos and not. But look, honestly, if you zoom out even a little bit, all this stuff is so underhyped. Like you can't hype it enough, right? I mean, it's just like it's just amazing. You know, like
it's incredible.
This technology works really well. It affects so many industries. Like people are like maybe disappointed that like it didn't solve every single one of their business problems like right now. And it's like, relax. Like obviously it will soon.
Just wait.
Just wait. Yeah. Wait a month, you know?
Come on. Exactly. There'll be a new model next month that can do it. Yeah. I mean, one of the exciting things, I don't know if you've had a chance. Have you had a chance to play with any of the AI assisted coding like Cursor or
yeah,
things
of course.
Like that?
Come on.
Yeah.
If you're not doing that, what's wrong with you? I honestly, when I come across an engineer, I mean, I think there's like, I think Cursor Code is like so much fun. I think that like really is it's a really well done product. Sorry, I mean Claude Code was what I'm saying.
Claude Code.
Yeah, Claude Code. I think it's really like just really like delightful. You know, like I think Cursor is also really well done. I mean, like you know, Windsurf. I mean, I don't know. I like them all, honestly. Like I think they change like so fast, and they're just like awesome. Like it's funny. You know, I'm coming into you know, CoreWeave and they like, you know, for them, like Kubernetes, they like know it so well. And I'm just like, they're like, oh, here's some machines, but you know, it's just like a Kubernetes cluster. I'm like, oh man, like I never learned how to do this, you know? And so, yeah, I just started asking like Cursor, like, hey, just like deploy my stuff, like in this Kubernetes cluster. And it's just sort of like, okay, you know, like has a couple questions and then it's just like firing off jobs. I'm like, yeah, this is
amazing.
I love it. Yeah. And then meanwhile, my daughter, you know, we use like Claude Code together to just like vibe code like weird games, you know, and I was like, you know, I tried with Claude Code. I mean, this is like so going to be so dated in a few months because everyone will know this. But I was like, hey, like, can you like deploy this so my daughter can show it to her friends, you know? And it's just like, oh yeah, make a Netlify account and I'll like put the app in there for you. And it really did, like in one, you know, like one script. It was so cool.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find myself like, anyone in my company that wants to work on something or like has an idea, I'm just like, can you just download Cursor? It's not that simple. You need to know how to code to be in a code editor. Like you do, like you still kind of do, but there are other tools that
are out Lovable. There. I don't know. My dad uses Lovable. He was making these crazy games and showing them to me. Lovable is great. I mean, there's other ones too, but that's the one that he was.
Yeah. Replit has one.
Totally.
V0. Yeah. There's so many, and I'm sure in like, you know, a couple of weeks there'll be another dozen that'll be doing something that's mind-boggling. It's amazing. I mean, the nature of work is changing. There are so many people that look at the negatives of it, but there are so many positives to it also. The democratization, like you were talking about earlier, many more people can do many more things. And it's such an exciting time. It's such an exciting time to be in. Yeah. What'd your daughter deploy?
I'll send some links. I mean, I mean, she's five. So the mind of a 5-year-old is like a weird place, you know, so yeah.
But that's so cool. She was able to do it. Very cool. Where do you see things in 3 years or 5 years? What's your take on like software developers? Do you think that there's gonna be like, do you think there's really gonna be a real hit to software developers, or do you think the nature of work's gonna change? What's your take on there?
Look, I don't know if I have any special insight. I do think like one thing that I'm seeing that's kind of, I've been thinking about a lot, and this is, it seems like you might have thought that this sort of be like more of a democratization of code. And certainly that's true, right? It seems like non-developers can like make stuff, but it seems like the more dominant effect is it's making the best developers even more productive than not the best developers. Like, I don't know, when you like meet the teams at some of these companies, like, you know, Cursor or, you know, Codium or Manus or something, it's just like, it seems like a small number of like incredibly hardworking, effective people. And so that's like, sort of seems like the winning strategy. Like, it just sort of seems like everything we do kind of increases inequality, like, unfortunately. And that it seems like that's what's happening, you know, right now. And it's very hard to predict. Like, I think like, if you had told me it would be able to automate a lot of code tasks, I think I would have thought, you know, the upshot of that would be like, wow, now I can like hire like more developers, be even, you know, more effective. But I'm not so sure that that's like the right thing to do right now. Like, even with, you know, with what we're seeing, like, it might be, you know, now like really small teams or even like one person can be more effective. I definitely think like, you know, engineers that have like more of a product mindset can be more effective, because the way a product manager is kind of like a prompt engineer, you know, for engineers, right? So, you know, it seems like
100%. Yeah,
it seems like moving up the sort of stack is probably, you know, probably like favors that. I don't know. You know, I think about it with like my kids too. It's like, okay, like, should they like learn to code? And it's definitely like, I'm kind of like, okay, like, learn to code as we do today, if it's like fun for you, in the same way that I think like woodworking projects are like sometimes fun,
right?
Maybe we'll have like artisanal you know, libraries like with some charming bugs in them. I don't know.
Yeah, that's funny. No, it's a couple of good points there. I mean, I'll start with the last one. It's like, you know, like, I had to like build a clock at one point in my life, and no, I never need to know how to actually build a clock, but I learned so much doing
it. Wow. Like, what kind of clock did you build?
It was like at camp, and it was like woodworking. And then we put like the motor in, and it was able to, wow, do it. Yeah. That's it was, cool. it was pretty cool. I remember like staining the wood and cutting it and sanding it and doing all that stuff. Like, no, like, do I ever need to do that stuff? But it's like being able to do it. I think there's like, one of my friends in college always used to talk about this time that he was working as a farmer, basically, and how much it changed the way that he just thought about everything, like what it takes to maintain a garden or a set of crops. It's like, those are the lessons that are very important that you need when you're doing anything that has anything that's not just like a one-time thing, right? Like, which code very much is. It's something that evolves over time. So being able to maintain and take care of your code is something that's very important. And then you also raise a really interesting point. It's like, yes, there is the democratization, but there's also the concentration of power, you know, whether you believe in like the 10x engineer or not, but a very highly effective engineer that's then able to automate more of their work is just going to become extremely effective.
Doesn't everyone believe in the 10x engineer? Like, how could you not? Like,
you
if you actually worked with engineers, I think that's like, I mean, I didn't want to assume.
I just didn't want to assume that you did, because some people are very much like, I don't know. I've seen a lot of polarity on that. Like, you know, some people really don't, and then some people really are. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm just not talking to the right people. I think that if you know engineers, you know that there really are people.
I can't imagine like working with engineers and not.
No,
they're a 10x engineer. Yeah,
no, 100%. No, there are people that are just capable of doing, that are capable of architecting things that just other people are not capable of doing, and make an impact that's just much larger on things. 100%. Yeah. But yeah, so I just didn't want to assume that that's what you thought too.
No, that's fair.
I'm moving into like advice and things like that. I'm gonna switch this one. What advice would you give yourself when you were starting your career?
Yeah, I think the most important advice I'd give myself is like, you know, Lucas, like you think you're late, but you're early. Like I just always felt bad. Like I graduated, you know, in like 2005, and I got an offer to go to Google, and I think I didn't take it honestly because I was like, oh, all my friends went there, like. You know, it's like, it must be like late, you know, I think my whole career is always like feeling bad that I was like late to stuff, but actually like, I was like early to everything. And so, I don't know. I think maybe that would make me just feel better about my career. Advice is tricky, right?
Yeah.
What advice would I give myself? It's probably something I should think about more.
That's a good one though.
And I think another thing that I realized later is like carving out like huge blocks of time to stay technical. I kind of felt like bad about that actually when I was like first, for like a long time. I felt like it was sort of like I had these coaches, like executive coaches, and like, look, if you go off for a week, you need to like come back with like something you produced and like a message to come. Like you can't just like disappear for a week. And then it's like, you know, fuck it. Like I disappeared for a week. Because I would go on like paternity leave and I would come back with like so many ideas. Oh, and like you can't really concentrate on paternity leave, you know, but it's like, I think like staying technical is going to like be like lots of ideas. Actually, I met the New Relic CEO and he was running a public company at the time. And he was like, you know, I spend 1 week a month just like basically by myself or with the smaller people just like writing code. And that like it was pretty inspiring. And I think another thing, it's like, you know, I think for a long time, like people have this stupid idea that you can have these like executives that don't stay technical or able to do like the IC work. And cause like management is like its own skill. And so you should hire like good managers, like not like good ICs. And I just think that's like so stupid. It's like, how many times do you have to see, you know, you hire someone who's like, seems like a good manager, but they can't do the individual work and watch them fail before it's just like, give me a fucking break. Like, you know, if you're going to like work for me, you better be able to do the IC job. And like, I do not know how companies function without that mindset. I'm just like baffled. I thought maybe it was just like me, but I think there's like a lot of bad executives that just kind of like keep their head down and somehow, you know, keep like shuffling around. And like, it's, you see like VPs of engineering that are pissed if you like ask them to like code in an interview. And it's, come on, I'd be excited. If you gave me elite code, Google code interview, I might not be like awesome at it, but I would be like pumped, you know, like Corey should have done that when they hired me, you know.
go back to the due diligence and tell them you want leak code. Give me more leak code.
CEO better be able to do leak code.
I love it. It's huge. I mean, getting shit done. I mean, like, that's what it comes down to, is you can talk about it and you can plan and you can do whatever you want, but it's like, are you able to actually execute, and are you able to actually get this done? And the amount that you can get done in a short amount of focused time is unbelievable. So you better have people around you that are able to do things. I think that in what I love about startups is that you don't have the time, you don't have the fat, you don't have that. You can't. You won't survive, right? If you're someone that can't execute, if you're somebody that's not able to get the job done, it's just like you can't really have a role at a startup. That's what I love about about entrepreneurship. Yeah, and thank you for the real answer. That was great. I like that a lot. So getting into just, you know, this is learning from machine learning. So I have to ask the question, what has a career in machine learning taught you about life?
Well, I think like one perspective that I have from, you know, machine learning, or one thing I think about a lot, like when you do machine learning, this might not be true now. I think most of my machine learning was done like building and fine tuning models. This is not like the new, you know, engineer stuff. But like, yeah, I think when you're like training models, you kind of don't know like when you should stop, like when something's like not working, like when you have, you know, an idea. So I think a lot about, okay, like when do we like pull the plug, you know, on this thing that I'm doing? Like how much information do I like really need, you know? And I think another thing is like the feedback loops are kind of like your unit of work. So I think like the faster you're like getting feedback and the more feedback that you're getting, I'm sort of like obsessed with getting, you know, feedback, whatever that means, you know, for whatever like I'm doing, kind of getting that like quickly to try to get, you know, better, whatever that thing is. I think that kind of comes from doing machine learning where you're just trying to get like the information on like, is this working or not? So I can like move on to the next experiment as fast as I can.
Yeah, that's interesting. So going to the first one where you're saying like knowing when to stop, are you particularly talking about like you're training a model and you're iterating on it and you're like, when is it good enough to go into production? Or like, yeah, when is,
well,
it?
Well, no, more like what I was thinking of is like, okay, you have a model. There's usually like an infinite number of things you could try to make it better, like get more training data, different types, different hyperparameters, different architecture, you know, all these different things, you know, and you're kind of like, okay, like what should I try? And then when should I like move on to trying like the next thing? And I think that's, I mean, it's funny. I was starting to say, I think that's like affected my life, but I think only the fact that I think about that a lot kind of comes from in machine learning, you like think about it a lot. And it's like, it's hard. It's, you never really get that feedback on if you like cut that experiment short fast enough. And I think different than like more like statistical practices, you kind of need to make these decisions within perfect information, right? Which is more like life, you know, like I think like medical stuff, I felt very familiar having like medical issues where I'm trying to look at a bunch of studies that don't kind of line up and none of them are like seem totally statistically significant, but yet you have to make a decision about your health that's important. That felt like a very familiar situation to me from machine learning, where, you know, you've done a bunch of tests, none of them are perfect. Probably there are like some bugs, you know, in like your code one time, and like, you know, so it's like questionable, like even, you know, if you can trust it. And like, so you have like a, you know, like 30 messy data points, and then you have to decide like where to, you know, what information to collect next, what to try next. I don't know. I think that's a common situation in life. I think machine learning kind of gives you a lot of practice, kind of like handling that.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I would claim to be good at it. I just, you know, you encounter that a lot until you get that perspective. And, you know, like running a company, it's like, okay, you know, you try some like new growth. Like it's funny, our head of growth, it was actually, she was a machine learning person, and it was like interesting to watch her, you know, kind of think in that sense. It was
Lavanya,
yeah. So her growth stuff felt a lot like machine learning, where it's like, okay, we're going to run these like 10 experiments. You know, we're going to like try to like cut them off with like imperfect information, get the 11th experiment in there. It kind of made me realize it was actually a really similar thing to trying to find the best, you know, ML model for some task.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that while in machine learning, you're dealing with uncertainty, also in entrepreneurship, you're dealing with uncertainty and making decisions, yeah, with imperfect information, and you can just make the best decision, you know, in that moment. And then going into your other point, about feedback, it's crucial being able to collect the right feedback, being able to understand how people are actually using the thing that you created, and then trying to incorporate that back into the model, whether it's, sometimes it's like, you know, obviously, you know, you could like change the data set that you train the model on, or you could change the way that the user interacts with your model and things like that. That's great. Is there anything else that you'd want to share about that, or?
Well, you know, I don't know. I guess I was like, you know, thinking about like you had an earlier question about like, how do you, like, what advice would you give yourself? And I think like one of the funny things that I've experienced in life is that you get a lot of advice that's like really good, and you just don't like do it enough, you know, and sort of like over time you like learn to just like do that like obvious thing that you'd obviously like tell yourself just like even to a more bigger degree than you're getting. It's like, I feel like asking customers for feedback is such a funny one where like, you know, just no entrepreneur does it enough. And it's like, it's not the only thing, right? Like, you know, like, I mean, just sort of blindly doing what customers want is kind of a stupid way, you know, to operate. But I think like understanding customers deeply and asking them like what they're thinking and like, you know, like what they would want. It's like, I really think I think all my co-founders, we really, like one thing about like all my co-founders, my two other co-founders, we all really had in common was we really felt like super bad when customers were unhappy. And we like worried about it a lot, and like, it really like hurt our feelings. You know what I mean? And so like I feel like we all kind of just like maybe a little bit of like an anxious style. Like we'd be like asking for feedback because we'd just be like worrying, like, okay, is there some problem? You know, like why aren't you using our product? And I think like getting that feedback from customers like all the time, you know, just like really, really helped us be successful. And it's so basic, but it's like, I like watch a lot of entrepreneurs like not do that. And I think even in my first company, I probably didn't do it enough. Honestly, as I'm talking about this, probably should do it even more, you know, now, but it's funny. Because everyone knows you're supposed to do that, but
right.
You know, I think it's just, it's like pretty annoying to do it. It's like a little bit stressful, you know, and, you know, we just don't do it enough.
Yeah. Well, you make a really good point. You've made many good points, but the point around, like, you don't just blindly take customer feedback and then apply it. It's the step of deeply understanding the pain and the problem and the need of your customers to then inform your roadmap and then to inform the decisions that you're making. And I think that that's where the challenge is that you can get tons of feedback from your customers, but the hard thing is to really have the empathy to put yourself in the shoes of your customers to understand what their problems are, what the incentives that they're dealing with are. I mean, I know that from my perspective, I think about the problems that I'm trying to solve, and they're often not the problems that my people who are going to pay for the software that I'm creating are dealing with. And it's that gap that makes that such a hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
totally.
Lucas, this has been like just like unbelievable. I said to you offline, but you're one of the people that I wanted to get on this podcast for so long. Yeah, it's incredible. Maybe you think that you were late or whatever. You were early to the game. You know, you've had such an incredible career, two successful exits, not exits, but you know what I mean in terms of your startups. It's really admirable. And also just the type of person that you are, it was so amazing, you know, getting to know you a little bit at Fully Connected, and just how real you are as a person, and not, you know, not the usual CEO. I really just appreciate you, so many of the things that you're doing, the incredible software that you're doing, but just, you know, the force that you are in this field. So thank you so much. It's really amazing to have the opportunity to talk with you.
No, thanks, Seth. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Is there anywhere where listeners can learn more about you?
Well, just go to WB.com. But if it's before Fully Connected, then they should come to Fully Connected. We'd love to have your listeners at our conference.
It's a great conference. I'm in New York. I don't know if I'm gonna be able to make the trip to California this year, but I'm sure I'll be there again in the future. I'd encourage people to come. Lucas, man, yeah, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, man.
On this episode of Learning from Machine Learning, I had the privilege of speaking with Lucas Biewald, co-founder and CEO of Weights & Biases. We traced this journey from programming games as a kid to building one of the most essential tools in AI development today. Lucas's career demonstrates that conviction often matters more than consensus. From surviving the AI winter in the mid-2000s to the AlphaGo moment that changed everything, Lucas reminds us that we're still early in humanity's most transformative project. He challenges conventional leadership wisdom and shares his unwavering belief that executives must stay technical. He explains bluntly, "If you're going to work for me, you better be able to do the IC job." Most importantly, Lucas's philosophy that feedback loops are your unit of work transforms how we approach both machine learning and life. His advice to his younger self cuts through common doubts. You think you're late, but you're early. In a world racing towards progress by any means necessary, this reminder couldn't be more relevant. Thank you for listening. Be sure to subscribe and share with a friend or colleague. Until next time, keep on learning.